From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Floating format for you tonight. We'll have open lines the last hour of the program tonight. Two Chinese businesses and a U.S. company have been indicted for their roles in making and importing a pet food ingredient that resulted in animal deaths last year. The Chinese companies and a Las Vegas-based company called Chemnutra were charged in two separate but related indictments, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Kansas City, Missouri. They said the tainted pet food led to the death and serious illness of countless animals right here in the United States last year. Several outbreaks of fish poisoning have been confirmed in consumers who ate fish harvested in the northern Gulf of Mexico. The FDA said the fish, such as grouper, snapper, amberjack, and barracuda, represent the most significant threat to consumers. They feed on fish that have eaten toxic marine algae. Now, the toxin is stable in the tissue of living fish, does no harm to them, but larger carnivores, like us, have higher concentrations of the toxin in their tissue, and as a result, the greatest risk of poisoning for humans comes from eating the largest fish as well. Symptoms of poisoning include vomiting, vertigo, joint pain, and the most serious cases, neurological problems, too. Outbreaks confirmed in Washington, D.C. and St. Louis. Overall, there have been at least 28 reported cases across the country. An unexpected number of deaths among patients receiving intense therapy to lower their blood sugar forced the National Institutes of Health to abruptly cut short part of a major study on diabetes and heart disease. The therapy was aimed at reducing to normal levels the blood sugar of type 2 diabetics at especially high risk of heart attack and stroke. Apparently, there were 257 deaths among people receiving intense diabetes treatment, compared with 203 in the standard treatment group. More than 18 million Americans have diabetes, with type 2 the most common form. Heath Ledger died from an accidental overdose of prescription medications, including painkillers, anti-anxiety drugs, and sleeping pills, according to the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. Mr. Heath Ledger died as a result of the acute intoxication by the combined effects of six prescription drugs in his system, they say. Residents in five southern states tried to salvage what they could from homes reduced to piles of debris a day after the deadliest cluster of tornadoes in nearly a decade tore through the region, snapped and crumbling homes near Tennessee, at least 50 people dead from the twisters. If you're wondering where your tax rebate check is from the IRS, well, you know the big promise from the economic stimulus package being developed in Washington. Don't hold your breath yet. It's stuck in the Senate as members, Republicans and Democrats alike, are arguing over whether to add and what to add to the version that passed last month in the House. The lawmakers still hope to get the bill to President Bush by February 15th, but the date is fast approaching. The year of the rat threatens to see a buildup of international tensions, natural and air disasters, and more turbulent stock market, according to soothsayers and analysts. As the year of the pig ends tonight, followers of Chinese superstition will be scurrying to consult fortune tellers, astrologers, as they guide their year ahead. Chinese fortunes are based on a belief that events are dictated by the different balances in the elements that make up the earth: gold, wood, water, fire, and earth. This year we'll see, they say, the earth element sitting atop water, suggesting an outward solidity built of sliding foundations. We're going to use part of this as open lines. In the last hour of the program, we'll get some of your predictions. In a moment, Charles Ostman joins us, currently the fellow at the Institute for Global Futures. We're going to be talking about the space race, energy, critical resources, and the geopolitical consequences. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, here he is, Charles Ostman, senior fellow with the Institute for Global Futures, a consulting group providing a strategic research, analyst, technical due diligence, and related technology-centric development services to Fortune 500 companies. We turn to Charles a lot for his trends and his look into the future. Here he is, complete program tonight with Charles Ostman. Hey, Charles, welcome back.
Greetings indeed. Thanks for having me on the air once again.
Oh, my pleasure. How are things, my friend?
Complex.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Can
we weed through this complexity?
It's going to be a challenge. And as I've said many times when I've been on your show in the past, and I always appreciate those moments, I look at evolution as a trauma-induced process, the theory being that as long as the trauma amplitude and periodicity does not exceed the system capacity to respond, it will come back more robust. And civilizations are the same way. We go through a series of challenges, and how we decide to negotiate those challenges either yields us as a better civilization, a better society, or we fall apart into chaos. And that's just the kind of thing we're looking at as we speak.
Is it because I'm getting older, Charles, or is it my impression that we are in some of the most turbulent times I have ever witnessed?
I think it's absolutely correct. And in fact, I want to give some credit where it's due. There's something called the Singularity Institute, founded by Ray Kurzweil and a number of other folks I'm quite familiar with. And I've been to their events, and in fact, I've used some of their images on the slides tonight. And they look at the exact same thing. They look at increase in complexity. They look at increase in interconnectedness. And they look at the shrinking of time, the very same things that I've been talking about for years. And here they are with a very different perspective, but they see exactly the same thing. And many other think tanks that I've become aware of, the Millennium Project's another one, which I'm also going to explain later, same exact thing. In fact, I work with the Millennium Group, and we chart different kinds of trends throughout the world. Same exact process. Things are speeding up, compressing, and becoming more, not difficult to manage, but require a larger scale of complexity in order to achieve management. That's all happening at the same time.
What are some of the latest things that are going on technologically that you see that will help us?
Well, everything is like a two-edged sword or a coin with two sides. And as I often give these lectures, and I just gave a talk at the Tesla Society a few weeks ago, some of the people in the audience suddenly stood up and said, oh, my God, this is all scary and strange. Well, everything is scary and strange if it's used the wrong way. The tools are beautiful, but they can also be used to cause great harm. So in that context, the tools that I'm most interested in, because I think it has the highest yield potential, is the rapidly moving field of nanotechnology, which is really material science, but now it's called nanotechnology. But the one that I'm really, really excited about is something called synthetic biology. And that's the ability to actually create organisms from scratch, to literally build things that turn into living systems. And that's where we're at this moment. And then the third thing that's around the corner is space. And I would like to offer the idea that however we or other entities throughout the world negotiate this next sort of space, I'm not sure space race is the right word, but next generation economic paradigm of which space will be at the center, that will determine how we function as a world, because it's happening right now as you speak.
Let's spend some time on synthetic biology. Does that include the creation, for example, of synthetic blood?
That's actually a company. There's actually a company that our institute was working with. We helped them get their patents, and they did some trials, and some of the trials worked and some of them didn't work. The military, of course, is very, very interested in this, as I'm sure you can imagine.
Oh, of course.
And obviously, also, I should point this out for folks that, you know, I donate blood myself once in a while. There's a worldwide blood crisis. As you probably know, blood here in this country tends to come from people who walk into a clinic and they get paid $5 or something and they get their blood.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is that nowadays there's so many strange diseases and pathogens that are being found in the blood. It's getting ever more difficult to come up with blood that's actually clean or acceptable from a sort of a epidemiological perspective. And this is a real difficult problem. So anything that can be used to either help augment the blood or replace it entirely, I mean, this is a huge medical interest. The economic value, of course, is tremendous, but it's still a work in progress. I don't want to say it's a done deal yet.
Sure. Isn't it true in the old days, and I'm talking about years gone back,
yes,
that somebody could have sat outside of a blood bank, drank a pint of booze,
yeah, sure,
in a paper bag,
that's right, exactly,
and stumbled in and yep, got his money for a pint of blood, right?
In fact, going back to the Clinton years, and this is probably going to be controversial, but there was a huge flap and several lawsuits are still being determined. because there was blood being taken from the prisons. And then it was sold to a Canadian company, and this gets kind of complex, and I won't spend too much time on it. But that blood ended up going into Europe in a variety of different places. And, of course, it turned out later that some of the blood did have HIV and some other things in there. And, you know, it was a real horrible nightmare, but it was a little snapshot of just how much of a problem this really is.
What is this? This is fascinating. What's this synthetic blood made with?
Well, again, the whole idea is to mimic hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is, of course, the agent that allows oxygen to be sort of transferred chemically to the rest of the body. So what you're really trying to do is you're trying to mimic the performance of hemoglobin as a chemical function. So there's a variety of different approaches to it. But before I go there, let me maybe back up a few squares.
All right.
Living cells are like machines, really. And every time people hear about nanotechnology, they think of replicators and gray goo and all this kind of crazy stuff.
Right.
And, you know, there's been books written, of course, Michael Crichton's praise for the most extreme, but there's other books. There's one which I don't have in front of me, but it's called Nano, and on the cover it actually shows the Golden Gate Bridge being dissolved by a cloud of nanites. And, you know, this is all nuts. This is all crazy stuff. But there is some truth a little bit. If you go into the world of biology and you open up any living cell, you find a bunch of little machine-like components in there. They're called organelles. And you have the ribosomes and proteasomes and the mitochondria and all these different components whose purpose is to break apart and reassemble molecules to satisfy the needs of the physiological system to which these things are connected. And they really are like little machines. I mean, they actually open up and close, and they have little valve-like or little sort of mechanical things that sort of move back and forth and grab molecules. And so, in a sense, to get just to that level of molecular interaction, it really is the nanotechnology of the current day. So the reason that the synthetic biology folks got to be so interested, because they realized that if we're going to take a shortcut to be able to manufacture things en masse in a much cheaper way than is traditionally done through more standard techniques, like, for instance, drugs, which is a huge interest in this kind of thing, instead of going through the usual chemical refinery processes, why not instead sort of borrow from nature and do what nature does? And I mean, there's all kinds of living cells out there that can replicate or produce extremely useful compounds that would be useful for the not just the human physiology, but for a whole lot of other things, just to create structures, components, even electronic circuits. I mean, the variety is kind of astonishing, actually. And so to unravel that mechanism was the real motivation to get into this world that's now called synthetic biology.
That's exciting, Charles.
It is.
And that's going to be a huge industry for emerging companies.
It is. And in fact, this is one of the things I want to talk about in terms of sort of this economic shift that we see throughout the world. Because as this kind of thing, we'll just take pharmaceuticals as an example. In the traditional world, the idea is you have to isolate a chemical or a molecule that performs some task that prevents some pathology from taking place or limits the pathology or does something to sort of change the behavior of a given cell or a tissue type. But then quite often when you take one of these drugs with this compound in over this molecule, and it has some kind of side effect, and then you have to go in and sort of correct for the side effect, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And to get these kind of drugs into the marketplace takes many, many years and billions of dollars. And once you've isolated the molecule in question that you're looking for, to actually synthesize it on a mass scale takes some of the most complex and expensive equipment on the planet. So it really puts a real clamp on the ability for pharmaceuticals, especially for the more obscure or sort of what you might call developing world diseases, because the scale of the markets in those areas doesn't really and I'm saying this in a kind of a careful way, doesn't really match against the actual cost of producing these things in the first place. However, if one could take a radically different approach and use living cells as the way to synthesize these materials and sort of grow them as opposed to refine them chemically, now all of a sudden the cost goes way down, and you can produce these things much faster and in a much more direct path than you could through previous means. That's one of the main motivations. But there's other motivations as well. There's a variety of things which are coming around the corner, whether it's photovoltaic materials or things that might be used in some kind of circuitry or thin films for a whole variety of applications, and that could be a real election itself. I mean, this is a whole variety of structures that, if they were created in the usual refining process, again, would be very expensive and also very non-green. In other words, when you manufacture these kinds of things, they consume a lot of resources, they consume a lot of water, and have a pretty large carbon footprint. And again, the motivation is to get away from that and these big centralized manufacturing processes, something which is much more granular and can be localized and not use that much resource, which means that even small countries, a lot of countries in Southeast Asia, for instance, and India and so forth, around the world, even South America, can suddenly step into these industries, which would have been impossible in previous times.
And is there another Microsoft out there or Apple computer that we can keep our eyes on?
Yes. Well, actually, yes and no. It's kind of a strange way of putting this. One of the real difficulties or one of the sort of question marks in the whole pharmaceutical industry is the question mark of IP, intellectual property, and who owns it and how is it owned and in what context. And that's gotten into some very weird territory, because if you start creating organisms from scratch, let's say you invent a new cell that could grow some badly needed material for, let's say, treating diabetes or something, and you could just grow this stuff in mass, well, what do you actually own? Do you own the organism? Do you own the patent on how the organism is used? Do you own the patent on the end resulting chemistries that you pull out of these living things? I mean, this gets very strange. And furthermore, the vast majority of the work that goes into these kinds of synthetic organism-like systems is mostly in software. There's a tremendous amount of modeling goes on before you finally get around to actually building the thing you're looking for.
That's true.
And in fact, that process is called in silico biology. And in fact, one of the slides I provided, thanks for Lex for doing this, shows an actual schematic of the living systems right there on the screen. And so the vast majority of intellectual property is not in physical chemistry, but rather in algorithms and very hidden in proprietary computer systems that only they know about. So trying to define who actually owns what piece of this puzzle, that's kind of a strange and newly emerging legal territory, which is still being defined.
In the old days, Charles, back in the 80s, the emerging biotech companies were hot. I mean, venture
I'm right here in venture capital heartland. That's exactly right.
What is that still happening?
Yes, yes, indeed. But they, again, because of the fact that it's a non-central, let me change that slightly. I mean, here in California, as some people probably know, we're having some kind of really interesting deficit problems. And one of the ways to help change the state of California's financial circumstances was to bring a lot of very heavy players in the biotech industry here, and basically set up shop and put their labs in here and so forth. So we have a kind of a concentration of those folks right here in the Bay Area. However, unlike other industries that are geographically confined to the resources available or to the situation, biotech is sort of different. It can be scattered almost everywhere. So even though there are certain areas or regions that are biotech-centric, mainly because of the politics involved, actually this can be done almost anywhere. And so it really is a different kind of model than some of the previous models.
Well, it's happening, and we just got to keep our eyes on it. It is exciting. Are we at the forefront here in this country, or are other countries better than us?
Well, and that's why I brought this up, because unlike other industries, we can't really claim to have just the only answer. And in fact, I've been to Washington, D.C. a number of times, and a few occasions I gave testimony or offered, you know, advice, as it were, to regulatory. As I actually spent 3 hours with the FDA one day and explained how nanomaterials might fit into new medical, you know, sort of products, as it were. And their problem was, how do we define this? What is it? Is it a drug? Is it a device? Is it a molecular system of some sort that we haven't even invented a name for? And this was a few years ago. And one of the things that I offered, and I think everybody kind of agreed with, I said, no matter what regulations you define here, it'll simply pop up somewhere else. In other words, there's no way to put this in a box and say, here's the box and here's how you identify it, because so many other countries are already doing this now. It's a different kind of model. It's not a top-down system where you can say, here's the regulations and everybody will obey these rules. It doesn't work like that anymore, and it's going to be popping up everywhere. And in fact, one of the reasons I kind of wanted to get into space a little bit is because one of the things that will happen in space will be manufacturing in very low or zero gravity environments. And interestingly enough, there's an enormous amount of interest in this, again, in this sort of biotech slash biological systems kind of approach to how to grow things or make things that couldn't be really done effectively here on Earth.
Because of the lack of gravity,
yes,
it makes it easier?
So, crystallized proteins is a huge interest in that. But one thing I wanted to sort of branch into, if I might, the space world as we once knew it is no longer a top-down monopoly. It used to be seen as NASA, United States, that was it,
right,
and Russia being sort of the number two or something. That's very rapidly changing. And what's emerging is an alliance between Russia, China, and India. And they've already signed treaties, they've already signed pacts, and they are moving very fast to become the new dominant entity in terms of payload capacity, lift capacity, and putting permanent industrial structures into orbit. And I'm going to offer a thought which may be controversial, but after all, it's coast to coast, so why not? But I believe this is the truth, and I really say that quite earnestly. I think to a certain extent, we were lured into getting into a war with Iraq. China was willing to put up the money for it. That's essentially, you know, they paid for this war, basically. You were, might ask the question, why would that be? Because after all, if we're supposedly buying up all their goods and, you know.
Hold that thought right there, Charles.
Okay.
We'll come right back. I'm George Norrie, Charles Ostman, our guest tonight, floating format, open lines, last hour tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got our guest, Charles Ostman. We're going to be back with Charles in just a moment. We've got the floating format for you tonight, which means the guest starts earlier. We'll do open lines the last hour of the program. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. When we last left you, Charles, you were talking about the Chinese funding our Iraq war.
Yes,
tell me
indeed.
About that.
Well, and just a little bit of background, if I can have a minute or two. It's a kind of complex, but I'll make it very, very concise if I can.
You've got 3 hours, Charles.
Well, you know, that can just
take all the time in the world.
Well, that's a nice thing. So thank you. So going back to, say, 2000 or even before, but year 2000 was kind of the milestone. India, China, and Russia kind of made a pact. They said, you know, we all have similar interests. We clearly see space as the new economic paradigm. We know that if we're going to go into the next century, we're going to have to go off-world to get energy and other material resources. That's just the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
The United States, meanwhile, they're sort of stuck in a kind of a strange paradigm. And, you know, I think that the Eastern Bloc is going to be the big new thing. And there was a lot of behind the scenes. You have to remember, of course, Vladimir Putin, who, of course, is running the show now, he remembers all too well back in the early 80s when he was the director of military intelligence. We, in a sense, lured Russia into Afghanistan as a way to put the final kibosh on their economy. I mean, even though we were doing SDI and everything else, and I was working in SDI myself, that was the final straw. And Putin has never forgotten this. So fast forward 20 years. When the word was going around that this was the new thing and that China was very eager to kind of work with Russia as a sort of financial partner, and India certainly has by far the spectacular engineering skills and very upscale electronic and, you know, sort of microsystem development work.
Hey, Charles, as they did about 2 million years ago.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Well, that could be another lecture, but I'm just trying to get this one little circle here.
No, I understand.
So it seemed like a very good jigsaw puzzle to put together, and Putin himself had very specific personal reasons to sort of want to kind of push this further. So when we made our move into Iraq, people in advance knew this was coming, and this may be more like Alex Jones territory. I didn't mean to necessarily go there, but I would submit that at least a small number of people knew something was around the corner. They knew that something was going to happen and that we would be kind of drawn into this conflict. Okay, fine. So it happens. Right away, China steps up to the plate and says, need money? Here it is. You know, as much money as you can possibly use. Knowing that we'd probably never be able to pay it back.
Right.
Now, why would they do this? What kind of strange logic would make this happen? People scratch their heads. Well, actually, it's very simple if you take this additional caveat view. If the ambition was to put us into an economic disadvantage where we'd be so bogged down in paying for this war and trying to recover our economy for other reasons as well, which I could go into if you wish, they knew that they would have us at a disadvantage for at least the next decade to come, which is precisely the amount of time it's going to take them to get their Triumvirate space program up and running and, and really sort of covering the world's interest in that context.
I think you're right. And we fell right into it.
Yes. Hook, line, sinker, rod, reel, armpit, you know, the whole thing. And, I mean, India now has a manned space pod that they're going to be launching in a couple of years. China's already ready to put their third person into space. They're going to have lunar rovers on the moon by 2010. They claim they're going to have people up there by 2012. On some of the slides I presented to your website, you may see a couple of little pictures there. This is just a very tiny sampling, but I invite anyone who wishes to do even a cursory web search, and they'll get, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents from the governments of these various nation states explaining in great detail precisely what they plan to do, what industries they plan to involve, and, you know, what their agendas are. And for several reasons. A, for obvious reasons, energy, I think, is the number one ticket. When you had Sir Charles Schulz on a few weeks ago, and somebody I have great admiration for, he's made this point many times. He said, look, if we're going to get serious about this, we would be putting orbital solar collectors, you know, overhead, and beam down converted sunlight that gets converted into microwave energy that would get in harvesting electricity down here.
Exactly.
This is not a new idea. I mean, I give him credit for his most recent updated
push.
But, I mean, Paul Werbos and others were doing this 25 years ago, trying to get these plans before Congress, and Congress never seemed to like the idea too much for various reasons. But elsewhere in the world, they get it loud and clear, and they are absolutely going to do this. In fact, one of the pictures I provided is actually a Japanese kind of a poster explaining Japan's program to do this. So, in other words, even if we don't seem to quite get it, or at least, let me say this more carefully, I've got a lot of friends in NASA and JPL and elsewhere, people in the aerospace industry. These are great people. They're very dedicated. They want to do the right thing, and they absolutely, you know, agree with these things. It's not the technical folks. It's the policymakers and the decision makers of the food chain that, for whatever reason, have decided to sort of ignore or just downplay these ideas, which is strange, but, you know, I'll just leave it said at that. But elsewhere in the world, they're moving ahead, and they will be doing this before too long.
Charles, couldn't you also develop a weapon by taking the sun's solar power energy and redirecting it?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. But once you're out in space, and I did work on Star Wars, so I can make some comments and some things I may not be able to because I'm not sure what's classified and what's not. But
so just say it.
The basic idea is this. If you have enough energy that you can then translate into some other form of energy, and in outer space you have almost infinite energy to work with, yes, even if it wasn't sunlight, it was a particle beam or a very specifically tuned laser that could penetrate through clouds. There's infrared lasers that can do this. You know, whatever the thing is, yes, you could absolutely have orbiting platforms that would be a look-down, shoot-down, zero-time flight weaponry system, as it's called. That's exactly what's coming around the corner. And we were designing these things ourselves 25 years ago, just that now there's a sort of a new paradigm. And I think part of the agenda would be to weaponized space, which is very, very sad. I don't want to see this, but I think that will be part of the process.
Someone's going to do it if we don't. I hate to say it.
And, you know, the thing is, if China, Russia, and India sort of collaborate, you know, India, by the way, has made it very strong that they don't really want to be involved with weapons, but that's just their input. But I can guarantee you China certainly will, and Russia's probably going to be part of it as well.
If they haven't already.
If they aren't already, exactly right, yeah.
You know, China knocked out one of their own weather satellites
in
the test.
Yes, indeed. Now, that was a demonstration so that everybody could say, look, see what we could do. Now, I should point out, by the way, back when I was working on these programs, we had ground-based lasers. And I won't say precisely what wavelengths or what power, you know, that kind of thing, but we did it. We actually showed we could do this. We could shoot down incoming MIRVs, multi-energy vehicle warheads, and we had other things that were planned to be put into orbit, which were kind of like these fortresses in the sky, as it were, that could, if something was flying around, they could shoot it down, that kind of stuff. So, I mean, these things are well known. But again, in modern times, because of the advance in materials and in nanotechnology and in ways to make materials behave that we couldn't do before, you can put a lot of power into a pretty small package, and you can deliver a lot of power to a target, even if it's pretty far away, in a much more effective way than you could in past times. And what's interesting now is that the pace of research is very different. If you go backwards in time, it may take 15 or 20 years to get from point A to point B in a particular development program. That time may be shrunk down to maybe 5 years now because so many things have already been invented, and the way to engineer and to produce things is much different than what it was. In other words, all the timelines that used to be associated with determining when these marker points would be crossed have shortened drastically.
Well, we went from what? Sputnik went up when? 57?
Something like that, yeah, 56, 57.
In 69, we go to the moon. So 12 years, we went from the first satellite in space to putting a man on the moon. Then we seem to go through this incredible period of lack of space technology.
Dormancy of sorts. And there's a lot of discussion about that. I don't necessarily have any precise ideas, but you're right. And the thing is that length of time, you would get orders of magnitude more technical progress to put that length of time to work now. And, you know, for whatever reason, set of reasons, maybe it's because we got involved in the Vietnam War, and that kind of took everybody's interest, and the money that would have gone to space went to Vietnam instead. And in a very sad way, I see the exact same thing happening now with Iraq. That's why I wanted to make that parallel.
Yeah, it seems like our priorities are all screwed up.
Or other folks have decided to force our priorities to go in that direction. That could be one more thing.
Yeah, but we are dumb enough to fall for it.
Yes, thank you so much. And what's interesting is, if you look at the cultures of Russia, India, and China, all these cultures are much more adept at what you might call long-term strategic planning. If they focus on a 25-year goal. They will get to the 25-year goal because that's the way their cultures have been sort of oriented to function over many, many centuries. In our culture, we sort of operate in the opposite time span. We work in like 4-year increments. We work in election cycles. We work in very tightly confined time slots based really on the political agendas of the moment, which is a good thing and a bad thing. In the one way of looking at this is that you can redirect and readapt to new ideas very quickly as opposed to being locked into a more rigid timeline. But the flip side of that says if you cannot maintain a long-term objective to suit a goal that has implications maybe 20, 30 years down the road, then you're not going to do well against others who already see that, and that's what they do as a standard practice.
The Chinese know how to wait. They have patience.
And the Russians do, too. The Russians should not be underestimated. I think Putin waited for 20 years to put this together, and he was like a spider in the hole waiting for his chance. Exactly right.
Do you trust him?
No.
Not at all.
And I'm saying this with real care because I have a lot of Russian friends, and I'm saying this really carefully. It's just a different kind of world. It's a more mercenary kind of world. I mean, it's like playing a game of chess. You always want to be, you know, sort of showing your pieces and moving things around. But behind the scenes, you have your strategies laid out. I mean, you have your alternative strategies, and then you have your secondary and tertiary alternative strategies. That's just the way it works. And I think for anyone to go into the world chessboard and try to play the game and not have this kind of mindset in mind is being naive. I mean, it doesn't sound very pleasant, but that's the reality of it. And so other players, they already go into the global chessboard knowing that this is the way to play the game, and they will play for keeps. And it's us that has to somehow figure out a compromise between what is appropriate or, I don't know, sort of democratically oriented versus the reality of how to play chess with these kinds of rules.
I'd love to see a chess game between Putin and President Bush.
I can tell you already who would win. And, you know, here's my thoughts on Bush. And maybe we should get back to technology, but just one little snapshot.
Well, but this all has to do with technology.
It does.
It has to do with the mindset,
yes,
and the direction we've gone over the last 8 years and
that's
even before that.
I agree with that. And that's why I wanted to throw it in there, because when Bush was put into office, this was a guy, I mean, there were three brothers, you know, Marvin, Jeb, and George W. And George W. was sort of like the odd man out. He was the one that didn't, you know, he wasn't really bright, but he sort of, you know, got his way through, you know, school and everything. And
right.
Wasn't exactly, he was like a C student or anything. And if it wasn't for the name Bush, he would never have been elected to anything.
He was the likable brother.
Yeah.
That somehow made a pretty good investment in a baseball team.
And well, sort of.
Correlated his money. But, well, he was pulled along.
He was pulled along. He wasn't the real thinker. He just happened to
be. No. He wasn't the thinker.
When the PNAC, the Program for New American Century folks, who've been laying in wait to put their PNAC doctrine into practice for, you know, 20 years now, in that they saw Bush as the perfect guy. And here's why. Because Bush, as the governor of Texas, knew nothing about Iraq. He knew nothing about the Middle East. This was, you know, another planet, as far as he was concerned. He was all very much confined to politics in Texas and oil and his baseball team and so on. So they found the perfect guy. They said, look, all we got is put him in there. He'll go along with whatever we say. He won't even ask questions because that's not his nature. And this will give us our chance to launch our PNAC doctrine.
Was that a Dick Cheney?
That was a Cheney, Wolfowitz, Crystal, Libby. I mean, there's a whole cabal of these folks who had been, Rumsfeld, yes, who had been part of this mechanism since the early Reagan days. And if you may recall, there was a very famous book written by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the Secretary of State in Carter's time.
Yep.
And that's when I was working in the Department of Energy. So, I mean, I was right in the middle of this whole thing when we had our oil crisis. And we all thought, okay, we've got to get serious. We've got to develop alternative fuels. We've got to get serious about wind and solar. I mean, this was going back to the 70s.
Interest rates were like 20-plus percent, if I remember.
Yes, that's exactly right. And had we stuck with the program, even though a lot of people criticized Carter, and you can debate that if you wish, that's your business, but had we stuck with the program at that time, we would not be where we are now. And the decision was made. There was a choice, almost like a dividing line. And when Zbigniew wrote his book called The Global Chessboard, speaking of chess, he said in very precise detail, he said, look, if we don't make a turn in the road now and decide to get out of the Middle East and their whole sort of oil complex situation, we will be forced into a global war with Islam within 25 years. And he actually cited Iraq as one of the entry points. And he just nailed it. I mean, he, you know, point by point, he sort of outlined the entire situation as we're seeing it now and said this could be the outcome if we don't, you know, go to a different direction. Well, for whatever reason, the PNAC doctrine crafters said, well, look, everything's okay. You know, the Saudis are our friends, you know, wink, wink. We have all our investments there. All we got to do is just kind of play along, you know, do a few bribes here and there, make sure the right people are sort of kept alive, Saddam Hussein being one of them, and it'll all be okay.
For now, yeah.
For now, exactly right. 15 years later, well, gosh. So, I mean, it's funny how people get deluded by their own delusions of grandeur, and your point is very correct, because had a different set of people been dictating policy at the time, really shaping policy, we clearly would have made different choices. So I certainly acknowledge your assessment there.
Yep. Where does Manuel Noriega fit into this scheme?
The Pineapple Man, yes, indeed. I've actually got a book called Our Man in Panama. It's like the definitive explanation.
Right. Yes, you do. That's right. Yeah.
Yes, it's a great book. It really explains this. Well, he was sort of a side issue, although he was a prototype for Saddam Hussein in a very similar situation, except that Saddam Hussein, his virtue or his interest, the reason we had interest in him was because, A, he was a check against Iran, and, B, you know, they occupy this gigantic amount of oil. So
even though
Manuel Noriega had a different set of parameters, the style and the process by which we put him into power and kept him in power, was a very almost like a template or a prototype.
Yeah, it was a blueprint.
It was a blueprint, exactly right. And so we thought, if it worked there, well, what the hell? We can work on a larger scale. I think that was actually part of the inspiration, as it were. And when Iran Contragate all came to light, that was a piece of that puzzle.
Amazing.
And sad. And because we made these bad choices, and because we've allowed ourselves to become exposed, to become blindsided to this very clever 25-year sort of chessboard approach, we're now going to be stuck in a horrendous debt situation. And I can tell you this much, just from flat-out knowledge, as long as we keep pouring more money into Iraq and kind of keep fiddling around, China will probably lend us more money and it'll sort of be okay. But the minute we start to compete and actually make a real play against their future ambitions, they're not going to lend us more money. Are you kidding? Of course not. And they're going to start calling in their marker. And that will be a very interesting moment indeed.
That's going to be checkmate.
We're at least close to being checkmate. Maybe not checkmate, but it'll certainly be. And my last thought is along these lines as follows. Everybody's so focused right now on the loan debacle with the subprime loans and all that. Well, okay, that's the surface veneer. Behind the surface veneer, you have to realize they had these major bank consortia and investment houses who, in advance, knew, because the rules have been changed, the SEC regulations sort of modified a bit to suit their favor, they were now allowed to collect these loans in huge bundles and sell them as commodities.
And they loved it.
And they loved it because they would make huge profits. And once they sold off the loan bundles, they didn't care. And a whole bunch of foreign investors took in these things. And now, of course, everything's kind of falling apart. But again, it was based on a very short-term, very limited, almost kind of microscopic view of how they can make short-term profits. And again, I think it was part of a trick that some of these overseas investors knew in advance this would further exacerbate our already precarious financial position. And this was part of a larger scheme, in my humble opinion.
I think you're right, Charles, about all of this.
Well, I'm sorry that's the truth, but that's, you know, and I say this with great agony, because there are times when I present these ideas to various audiences, and some people just laugh and think it's all conspiracy stuff. Other folks will say, yeah, you're right, and they give me further information. But there is this sort of a disconnect between the folks that are willing to try to express these ideas and the folks in Washington who, you know, don't want to hear them at all. The only hope we might have, maybe, is if we do have a regime change of sorts, whoever gets in there next time around might have a different agenda, because they can see that the end is now approaching. In other words, I think people in the past thought that they could pull off the Ponzi scheme and keep it long enough so that they could sort of bail out and nothing happened to them.
Right.
But the Ponzi scheme is falling apart faster than they realize, and that may be our saving grace in a way.
Well, you may be right, because I think they're looking for ways now to get out of the game, and they don't know how to do it.
But they're looking around for answers. So maybe in the next hour we could talk about things like nanotechnology, alternative energy programs, and other technical ways that we could sort of become the new technical power in the world, or at least a player, and sort of put people back to work and sort of get ourselves back on the road to something that resembles stability. But it's going to take a very coherent, long-term view to get to that point.
But we can do it, because we're Americans, Charles.
We can, and we're not dead yet. I mean, yes, we're on life support, and the machines are cooking away, and then we have tubes coming in our body, but we're not dead yet. And that's the whole point I wanted to make, and I can offer some thoughts on that maybe in the next hour.
We can make a remarkable recovery if we do it right.
If we became the world's purveyor of advanced green technologies, as it were, and actually could really push the envelope in terms of efficiency, being able to harvest energy, and I'm going to go into some things about synthetic biology and how it plays into that role, we could once again become sort of the center point of this kind of research and selling products. But we have to make it the national imperative. We have to actually make it to the point where Because, look, right now, you were talking about venture capital. I'm in the middle of what you might call the new Silicon Valley, or I'm going to call it the Green Valley, because we have lots and lots of very smart people who have come up with really interesting ideas, looking for funds, looking for venture funds. And it's, I mean, for 1 month in Iraq, we funded these little companies. We could turn this around. That's
absolutely. It really is. Stay with us. Charles Osmond, our special guest. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.